This is exactly right.
Forgive me for interrupting. I'm Bridger Weiniger, host of I Said No Gifts on Exactly Right. Each week, I invite my favorite people in comedy over to chat, and they always bring a gift. We're coming up on our 200th episode, and every episode is a gem. I have welcomed all kinds of great guests, including Cola Scola, Bowen Yang, Robbie Hoffman. It goes on and on and on. And you don't want to miss the 200th episode with the great Maria Bamford. What does she bring me? Find out April 25th. New episodes every Thursday. Follow I Said No Gifts wherever you get your podcasts.
And welcome.
Welcome to My Favorite Murder.
It's the podcast you listen to, the true crime podcast, remember?
You remember. You were there that one time.
All those times?
That's Karen Kilgariff. Hi, Karen.
Hi, that's Georgia Hardstark.
Hi. We got back yesterday from the last weekend of a 5.5 month, 2 season tour.
Yeah.
The summer off.
Hi, we're taking the summer off.
That's right.
Well, we'll tell you all about that later. It'll be fun. You'll still get episodes. Don't worry.
Yeah.
But we are also simultaneously going to take vacations.
We're going to go to a 3-month-long silent yoga retreat.
Yes, in Nova Scotia.
Right, where we eat vegan.
Seal.
Vegan seals the whole time.
Yeah, we eat with vegan seals.
Right.
So it's seaweed, seaweed, seaweed.
Swim with dolphins.
It's going to be amazing.
And that's all we're doing.
But also, yeah, so it's silent. So all the podcasts will be silent throughout the summer.
That's right.
Just around an hour and 28 minutes of just silent vocal.
Screaming.
vocal drag. What's it called?
Oh, vocal fry.
Vocal fry. But silent.
But
spiritual.
Seals.
Yeah.
Seal vocal fry.
And Seal the vocalist.
That's right.
Yeah.
What a great vocalist.
Remember him.
A couple quick things. Let's get them out of the way. Our fucking book comes out in a week.
That's
right.
Holy
shit.
6 days you're going to be able to buy Stay Sexy and Don't Get Murdered, the dual memoir by Karen Kilgariff and Georgia Hardstark.
That's right. May 28th. If you've pre-ordered, thanks.
Thank you.
If you haven't, thank you. Thanks.
Thank you.
It's
we love that kind of push-pull. Where you're making us earn it. God, we want to now.
And the audio book comes out the same day, so you can keep listening to our fucking voices. Yes, we read it ourselves.
We did, yes.
Yes, Paul Giamatti makes a fucking cameo.
Paul Giamatti is one of the guest narrators. It's magical.
Yeah.
The whole thing is nuts.
It is.
And then there'll be a very, very brief book tour.
Very brief, very angry book tour.
Yeah, or is there going to be a lot of anger?
Let's just do angry.
Okay, I mean, easy. New York, Portland, LA.
Yeah.
Prepare for our rage as we talk about this book.
Go to myfavoritemurder.com for details. And also there you can find details about our Santa Barbara weekend in November that we're doing.
Yeah, did you hear about My Favorite Weekend?
So it's basically like instead of going on a weekend tour at a couple different places, we're fucking taking over Santa Barbara. We're kicking out all the residents.
Yes.
They're really angry about it.
That's going to be tough. We're bussing them out.
That's right. But we're keeping the pets so we can hang out with them.
Right.
And we're going to do a live show. Fucking the Murder Squad's going to do a live show. Percast is going to do a live show. It's just going to be, and then you guys are going to have a chance to like meet up and hang out and special events. And it's going to be fucking cool.
Yeah, it's like a mini con.
Yeah.
Vention.
We're conning you.
It's a con for sure.
It's a long con.
It's the long con all the way through November.
Yeah.
So again, go to myfavoritemurder.com to find out all the details.
Yeah.
And
think of it as a cruise, but you don't have to throw up over the side of the boat unless you really want to.
We will have a throw up section.
Sure. We always do. It's the whole theater.
Oh man. Somebody always comes through for us in that way.
That's true.
So yeah, but yeah, exactly. We won't get caught on, in high winds.
Mm-mm.
Or rough waters. None of that is, is anything we're going to be bringing to the table.
No, you don't want to look over and see dolphins or anything obnoxious like that.
No, not at all.
It's just be us.
But you will be paying top dollar for My Favorite Murder Weekend. So
there's a bunch of different packages and hotel and all this stuff.
So. Look it up. See what fits you and then come and hang out with us for the weekend. We're really excited. It's going to be super fun.
Yes. Oh, luminol mugs.
Oh, yeah.
This might be luminol.
Yes.
We have a travel mug and a regular mug on My Favorite Murder on the store. I fucking love those.
Now, am I right about this, that they light up in the dark?
They glow in the dark. The luminol glows in the dark.
The word luminol glows in the dark.
You know those people who have those mugs that say, this might be vodka. And it's like Cheryl in accounting. You're like, mm-hmm. Cheryl, you're so crazy.
You nut, Cheryl.
That might be wine.
Alcoholic Cheryl.
Yeah. Well, now you can have one that says, this might be luminol.
Yeah.
Which don't drink that. Don't drink luminol. It's poisonous, probably.
And it's a waste. People need it to spot other liquids.
Someone gave us vials of luminol at a live show recently.
Yes.
And I just was like, let's go to the hotel room and fucking throw this about.
You said that, and then the woman who gave it to us went, no!
She knows, meaning she's done it.
She's like, do not. You don't want to see what's going to come up under that black light.
I don't. What do you have?
A lot of people got very fired up about what the best cracker treat combination is. Is this something we should talk about a little bit?
Always. Snacks.
Because people really, Stephen goes.
Snack corner.
Stephen goes. Oh, I've got some responses for the for that snack when you said this is the best snack cracker.
Yeah.
And then he just handed me like eight printed pages of responses from people.
Can I get a copy of those, please?
Yes.
I take it very seriously, but credit goes to Jay for finding those.
So. Oh, did he find them?
Yes, he did.
There was one guy, and I wonder if it's in here because there's so many, where a guy just, he DM'd us. And he just wrote on the Twitter, which I actually never look at the DMs of, because it's like, oh my God, that's It's open DMs. That's a nightmare. Mm-hmm. But
DM all over the floor.
All over the place.
It's really gross.
But for some reason, I opened it and then it just said, graham crackers with peanut butter, boom. Just like someone that just like, this discussion is over about what the best cracker
also, like,
snack is.
We're not in the middle of this discussion. Like, we talked about that 2 weeks ago.
Yeah.
Maybe
for him.
Yeah.
That's how every response on social media is for the person responding and going, I'm going to log on Twitter and let them know how I feel. It's always, it just happened for them. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes they're like, I need to talk about what happened in episode 64. And it's like, no, we're not doing that anymore.
I don't even remember being alive then.
People walk up to us wearing shirts of things we said on this podcast at the meet and greets. And every time I go, oh my God, that's so funny. And then they'll go like, you said it, or like, she said it to you. And we're like, really? This is great.
Or it'll be like, you said it last episode. And it's like, holy shit.
Oh yeah, that's a bad sign.
Speaking of snacks, can I just say that someone sent us a snack pack backstage when we were just in Minneapolis without an explanation. And I just, I hope they're okay, because it was onion and chive, or like onion and garlic crackers.
Yeah.
Cottage cheese.
Oh, that's right.
And then mint fudge. And I was like, this can't be right. I hope they're okay.
Okay. Well, you would say that, right? Having not read a couple of these pages that Stephen handed me that Jay found.
Give me some highlights.
So get up on this. Like, this was the first one I saw from someone named Jordan. And a lot of these are coming through just as like listed out recipes. So it just says the number one, saltine. Two, smear some creamy peanut butter on it.
Okay.
Three, slice dill pickle.
Ew.
And then here's the underneath that. Do not say gross until you ingest it. It is creamy, sour, salty, crunchy, and sweet.
No.
My fave hungover snack, which may also be a new subgroup name, Peace and Blessings, Jordan. People got into this.
That sounds gross, but yeah, I guess not.
It's kind of good. Then there's really fancy ones, like this is from Kayla, and she wrote, here's my new favorite snack ever. I don't know if there are Aldi's in California, but they sell an artichoke jalapeno drip.
Drip.
It says dip. I said drip.
It's a fucking injection. You put it into your arm. And
it's a slow jalapeno drip.
They fucking have an artichoke jalapeno dip at Trader Joe's. That is so good.
I wonder if that's the same.
I bet it is. Okay, what does it say?
So she says she spreads it on thick sliced salami wrapped up, mm-hmm. and it's the easiest and most delicious snack.
All right.
So she's using the salami as the
gluten free.
Loving it. Oh, and then she says, if I'm feeling really crafty, I'll add a Ritz to everything cracker. Ritz everything cracker to the mix. Wait, there was a couple of them that, how about this? This is from Steve. My favorite cracker is something that my mother got me addicted to while I was just a little kid. It's her favorite snack as well. Step one, take a delicious buttery Ritz cracker. Many of these are Ritz cracker based.
These are all, recipes. This is fucking Ritz. Employees being forced to email us. I know what you're, we know what you're doing, Ritz. You don't get a free fucking commercial out of us.
Ritz and Triscuit are going head to head in this corner.
Promo code, fuck you.
Step two, put a dollop or a smear, if you're Georgia, of cream cheese onto it. Uh-huh. Step three, top with a smoked oyster.
Oh.
So I guess this is from the 1%. They sent an email from the elite strata.
Smoked oysters are for hobos. What are you talking about?
Hold on. She said, Steve, who calls himself a crackerino. I understand full well that this sounds like some people's version of hell, and had I not been raised on this delicacy myself, I wouldn't likely try it either.
No.
But something about it is so savory and salty and buttery, and at the same time, that is pure bliss. You really should try it.
Wow.
Stay sexy and don't avoid seafood that comes in a can and is readily available at the dollar store.
Oh.
Steve Crackerino.
Mercury poisoning, aisle one.
That's the savory taste, is that mercury under the underpinnings of mercury.
Is your death being closer?
Then there's stuff like, there's some people that are genuinely being fancy. Mm-hmm. So it's like
caviar with caviar.
It's no, not really. Oh, this one I like. This is from just the letter A. As for cracker snacks, the best ones I ever ate was when I was a little kid at vacation Bible school. Oh. You take a Ritz cracker.
Of course you do.
Top it with a little bit of jarred spaghetti or pizza sauce.
What?
And mozzarella cheese and toast it in an oven until melty, and voila.
Toasted Ritz.
Vacation Bible school pizza crackers. My son once had a party and I made those. They were all 5 years old. And one kid raved about them so much that the mom had to call me and ask for the recipe.
Damn.
A little pizza Ritz?
That's adorable.
It's actually pretty precious.
That's a step above.
I mean, yeah, it just goes on and on this
Maybe
way.
Maybe we'll post some on the fan cult.
Here's the thing. Do you remember why apricot jam got mixed into that other recipe?
Yeah, because I'm crazy and said that you should put a little apricot jam on top of your pickle and whatever, Ac-Mac and what was it?
Yeah.
And pepper jack.
Pepper jack.
Yeah, and I fucking stand by it.
Have you eaten that?
Not with a pickle.
Okay.
But I'm definitely a jam and cheese person for sure.
I've been hip to that with you and your charcuterie boards and the cheese boards that I'm now. I used to on like hotel menus be like, that's not for me.
Yeah.
That's not my area. And now I'm like, I believe it to be my area
I
entirely.
Opened your eyes to mm-hmm. the, asked for a little bit of honey on the side.
And maybe some of that good young fig jam that I love so much.
Right.
That's always good. Anyway, snacks abound. You know what we should do is take all these and put them on the website.
For sure.
Cracker Corner.
For sure.
I'm gonna file those away too.
Cracker Corner.
Shareables.
It is crappening.
I mean, look, it just keeps going.
Oh, I need a copy of those for my recipe book.
For to go right in there.
For my recipe folder. Who goes first? Steven?
Georgia goes first this week.
I don't know why it's such a relief to go first, you know? Just like
that much closer to being done. Yeah. You guys, we love doing this podcast.
No, we love it. But there is something about going first to me that's just like, then afterwards I can relax and just listen to yours, crack a can of wine, fucking chill out.
It's a bit of a hang.
Yeah.
But also I think like I've gotten very comfortable complaining on this podcast about being tired and being doing other stuff, which I shouldn't be like that.
Well,
it's hard
true.
Not to.
It's true and true. So
I tie.
I mean, we're so fucking happy and this is amazing. But yeah, I think, and a lot of people have been saying to us, like, you guys can take a break. It's okay.
Yeah.
And I think we're finally catching up to that.
We're like, oh yeah, that's right. We should do that.
My therapist today, when I was just weeping in therapy, which is not like me, he's like, yeah, you seem exhausted. Mm-hmm. Like, you've never said that to me before. And I was just like, can you leave me alone so I can just cry for a minute?
Yeah. Please witness my emotions.
Can I get a witness?
Can you? I need credit that I cried right now to show that I can and that it's important to me.
Then fucking Vince, because it was couples therapy that we got back in the car and I was like crying. And I was like, I feel like I shouldn't stop because this never happens to me. And he's like, totally, I'm here for this. And then he makes a joke and I start fucking laughing. I'm like, God damn it, Vince. I made some silly, cute joke that just made me laugh. I was like, fuck.
There was some, my sister sent me something because I was doing, while we were gone, I was having some emotional upheaval.
Turmoil?
It just felt like a, almost like stomach flu. It felt like that kind of thing where it was like, it was not connected to anything specific, but there would just be like these weird weepy.
Like bouts?
A bout of weeping. And then it would just kind of come over me and then I'd just be like, just let it do it. Just let it be here and then let it go. And like barf it out or whatever. But of course, kind of similar, but probably exactly opposite event is when I call my sister, because I almost never, I'll call her to talk about stuff.
Yeah.
But I won't ever call her like losing my mind.
Yeah.
Because I know that actually she doesn't like it. Who does? Who does really?
What's wrong with her?
But she's, but the funny thing is when you do, she's really good at like, she's really good at just like in the moment or just being, okay, hold on a second.
Snapping because
what you don't realize. Yeah. And then she'll kind of bring everything else into perspective. And she's really, it's very funny because you wouldn't think it, but she's really into horoscopes and astrology type of things.
Yeah.
So she immediately sends me this astrology meme thing.
Yeah.
All about how there are these solar storms and
it's not your fault.
It's not your fault. And because you're so sensitive and you're such a, you know, you're such a
empath
or air sign or whatever the fuck it is that like that's the reason this is all happening.
I've always
to you.
Thought that about you, Karen. Like, oh, she's such an air sign.
I'm an earth sign, actually.
Oh, a what sign?
Earth.
An earth.
I'm earth.
I thought you said a nurse sign.
I'm just a nurse. I'm just posing as a nurse.
Oh, I'm a firefighter sign.
But then it actually feels good when, even though we can all argue that it's bullshit or it's just too far away to actually affect us. And yet, how does the moon make our periods happen? But
it fucking curses us.
It does. But it's interesting when things like that happen and then you can just kind of go like, then it's like, this thing is passing through and now it's a time of renewal.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, that's good. It's good to like emote, barf it out and let it
and
feel
blame
like.
Blame it on something else.
Blame it on something else and then be like, I'm renewed. Yeah. I'm going to do something else now.
I'm a flower. I'm opening up. Well, I'm getting my period every 2 weeks. So that's how stressed out I am.
Oh,
so that's
no.
Fun. Yeah, it's not good.
Are you going to get that looked up?
Uh-huh. Looked up in the dictionary? I am.
Right up that dictionary.
Put that speculum right up my dictionary, please. And tell me what the fuck is wrong with me.
And just tell me. Give me some definitions.
Oy vey.
Georgia, have you ever been blown away by the most simple dish at a restaurant? Like perfectly scrambled eggs?
Oh my God, yes, Karen. And then all I want to do is make that dish at home and eat it every day.
Well, you probably could, as long as you have the chef's secret ingredient, Made In cookware.
Made In was created to bring restaurant quality performance kitchenware to home chefs around the world.
For years, they've built their business by supplying restaurants and top chefs with high-end cookware. Some of Tom Colicchio's most treasured dishes at his restaurant Kraft are made in Made In.
Whether you're cooking for professional critics or just the critics you live with, your meals will benefit from the quality of Made In products.
Like their carbon steel cookware, it combines the best of both cast iron and stainless steel clad, so it's rugged enough for grills or an open flame. It's the MVP of summer cookouts and cook-ins. What I really love about Made In cookware is that it actually makes something like having a Memorial Day barbecue much more convenient because you can keep everything on the grill. If you need to throw, say, a pan of garlic up on the top while you're grilling your steaks on the bottom, it's strong enough, durable enough to do that.
If you want to take your cooking to the next level, remember what so many great dishes have in common. They're all made in, Made In.
Save up to 25% this Memorial Day from May 18th through May 27th when you visit madeincookware.com.
That's M-A-D-E-I-N cookware.com.
Goodbye. There's something about the sound of an old-timey cash register that really takes me back.
I know. It sounds like someone is about to hand me an ice cream cone, but it also sounds like we just sold some merch.
That's right. And if you're a Shopify user like us, you know that this sound means you just made a sale.
Shopify has helped millions of businesses sell their products online, but did you know they also offer the same support for brick and mortar stores?
From accepting payments to managing inventory, they have everything you need to sell in person. So give your point of sale system a serious upgrade with Shopify.
Shopify POS tracks sales across all your locations. That way, you'll always know what you have in stock and where.
They also provide reliable tech that fits your unique retail needs, like turning a tablet into a credit card reader.
And if you're looking to reach new customers, check out Shopify's marketing tools. They're easy to use, and they integrate with all social media platforms.
With Shopify, we have a powerful partner for managing our sales. And if you're a business owner, you can too.
Do retail right with Shopify.
Sign up for a $1 per month trial period today at shopify.com/murder. And here's the important note, that promo code is all lowercase.
So go to shopify.com/murder and take your retail business to the next level.
That's shopify.com/murder. Again, don't forget, the code is all lowercase.
Goodbye.
Okay. Well, guess what?
What?
So, you know, sometimes I like to do stories that aren't exactly murders, or just morbid, like death set in an amusement park.
Yes.
Deaths at a different amusement park.
Yeah, a different one. Yep.
Right. Those kinds of stories.
And a third amusement
and
park.
And another amusement park, even.
You've done three, I think.
I think you're right. Yeah.
Yeah. I love any off the beaten path version.
So this one is morbid, but it's not murder, because I kind of was like, I can't keep murdering. This is too much. So this is one of the things that when I found is another one like deaths at an amusement park that when I found out about, I just buried my face in the articles for hours and hours and hours. And I go back to it all the time because I just find it so fascinating.
Let's hear it.
These are just some of the bodies on Mount Everest.
Oh, shit.
How about that?
Yes.
You here for this?
Yes, I am.
Do you ever do any, have you ever, I'm sure you click open those
have
articles.
Have I climbed it?
Yeah.
Yes. Me, I went to base camp A. No, but you know what I did? I've seen a couple of those documentaries. Mm-hmm. And going into them, I am not interested in a climbing life.
Right.
I'm not interested in, to me, it seems like you're signing up to probably die.
Right.
Like there's so many things that can go wrong.
Yeah.
But I am fascinated by people who are so driven by a thing like that.
Yeah.
It's so interesting to me without having anything in common with it. You
see,
know
it
mean?
Kind of pisses me off in a lot. Like, I'm just like, just chill out. Mm-hmm. No, it is so foreign to me that it's crazy.
Okay.
So I got a lot of information from an article on Ranker by Sabrina Eiffel and a website called mpora.com by Tristan Kennedy and allthat'sinteresting.com by Katie Serena. And I mean, there's just so many articles all over the internet you can find.
Yeah.
So here we go. Karen, 200 bodies still remain on Everest, with nearly one out of every 10 climbers perishing atop the mountain on average.
One out of 10?
One out of 10.
Those are bad odds.
Those are terrible odds.
Hey, rich people.
Yeah.
Those are bad odds.
I mean, let's be honest. It's fucking, it's rich people with a lot of time, or it's...
It's, yeah, the, it is. I think that's what it is.
Yeah. Or it's like CrossFitters who take it too far.
Yeah, I mean, there's probably like the camp of like, no, I've been in this since I was a kid,
yeah,
and
climbers,
I've been sponsored or something, but,
yeah.
But yeah, I feel like
that's true.
But when the odds are 1 in 10,
yeah,
like what if you were? It was like that's what the odds of camping were.
You wouldn't
be like, oh, here we go. I'm just gonna roll the dice.
It's a weird thing of like, well, thinking you're special. You know what I mean? Where it's like, you think you're special, but really, there's a lot of it that has nothing to do with you,
right? Because it's nature at its most vicious.
Yeah.
Air that barely exists.
Mm-hmm.
Like the basics that humans need.
Let me tell you.
Please tell
it.
Me.
Okay.
I'm telling you what I don't know. How about you tell me what you do know?
Okay. Frozen corpses have become almost run of the mill on Mount Everest.
Oh.
Everest has claimed the lives of almost 300 climbers since the first attempt to conquer the mountain in 1921, two-thirds of whom are buried in the mountain's ice and snow. So two-thirds of the bodies of people who have died there since 1921 are still fucking there.
Right.
Despite the risks, thousands swarm to Nepal every year in an effort to conquer the tallest point on Earth, and many of them never leave.
No, they don't.
So Mount Everest is 29,000 feet. It's the world's highest mountain above sea level. It sits directly on the border of Tibet and Nepal, and mountaineers are crazy about it. More than 296 people have died trying to climb it. I think like I'm throwing out a lot of numbers that aren't adding up, but let's just keep going.
Well, 296 clearly got rounded up to 300, which is what happens in so many articles.
I said almost 300.
Yeah.
And I was right.
You're fine.
Most deaths have been attributed to avalanches, injury from fall, Sirac collapse, which I think is a climbing thing, exposure, frostbite, or health problems related to conditions on the mountain. And not all bodies have been located, so there's not a lot of details on like how those ones died, so they can't be like most people died from this or that
because they just don't know where they are.
Yeah, exactly. So it could be a fucking meteor for all we know.
Could be the Yeti, which I absolutely and 100% believe is real.
That's true. It's happening.
Okay,
so Everest, because of all the bodies that are still on it, it has the title of the world's largest open air graveyard.
Ooh.
Which, like, God, that sucks. Dark. I thought that was like, yeah, right?
Well, also, yeah, I think that's not what people would think of first.
The world's largest open air graveyard. The upper reaches of the mountain are known to climbers as the death zone. And the death zone is a mountaineering term for altitudes above a certain point around 26,000 feet, where oxygen level is not sufficient to sustain human life. You knew.
Yeah.
So when the human body enters this altitude, it just starts dying immediately.
Yeah. Yeah. Like
that, it's not insane. It just starts stopping to work.
And people are prepared to start dying and push on through it?
Yeah. Or? So in the death zone, the human body cannot acclimatize. Is that right?
I think so.
As it uses oxygen faster than can be replenished. So it becomes a race against the clock. You have to. So at that point, they have to race to get to the summit.
Okay.
So
as they're dying.
So okay. they don't fully die.
Okay.
And then back again before their body fails them. Since oxygen at this level is only a third of what it is at sea level, climbers find themselves sluggish and disoriented and fatigued. And the pressure.
I can relate.
Welcome to my life, sweetheart.
What's up?
The pressure, because of that, makes the weight feel 10 times heavier than it actually is.
Same. All over it.
And causes extreme distress on organs.
Mm-hmm.
Is this you?
My liver is crying right now.
Because of this, climbers usually only have a window about 48 hours inside the death zone. And so they can get up and fucking back before. And they're strongly urged to use supplemental oxygen at all times. But there are these crazy fucking people that are like, I want to do it without oxygen.
Yep.
Like as if somehow they're, you know.
Well, you know what that makes me think of is like when they go to the party, when they get back, and you know they talk about climbing Mount Everest for the rest of their lives.
Yeah.
But that those details at the cocktail party when they are bragging will be lost on everyone.
Right.
So
okay.
The kind of the thing that they is the biggest victory, people are just going to be like, right, the death zone, yeah.
Yeah.
Like,
oh, you didn't carry oxygen with you? Why?
Oh, because I thought everyone could take a toot if
yeah,
they wanted to.
Yeah, why wouldn't you do that? It's just, it's like.
Do you remember? Sorry, I just had this recovered memory.
No.
In 9/11.
That you climbed Everest?
That I climbed Everest forgot to brag about it. No, that on 9/11, there was a doctor running into the rubble and he kept saying, can I take a toot of, like there was like a, you know, either a fireman or an ambulance worker standing there. And he was taking, as he called it, taking a toot and then running into places to see if there was anyone alive.
Did he make it?
Yeah, I believe so. But I mean,
how did that come, taking a toot?
That was like literally live. CNN was just going live to fucking ground zero and being like, what's happening?
And then suddenly someone, you're like, this toot is not the right word for this fucking
but
moment.
But he was like, it was like this fuck, he was a guy in scrubs.
Shit.
And he was just like, we got to get in there, give me a toot. And then fucking
like
running in.
That's what they call it. Let us know, everyone, doctors, nurses,
doctors
ambulance.
That do cocaine, let us know if that's
toot.
Actually what you call
okay. Where was I? Okay. So many deaths at high altitude mountaineering have been caused by the effects of the death zone, either directly because of loss of fucking vital functions in your goddamn body, or indirectly, which I think this is interesting, because you make unwise decisions when you're under stress or physical weakening leading to accidents. So you become, it's like when you have what's it called when you're super hot and the sun's beating down on you?
Just sexiness?
No, you know.
Sunstroke?
Sunstroke. And you start taking your clothes off, or when you have frostbite and you take your clothes off to cool down. But right. That's not what happens. It's like your body is sending you the wrong signals. So you do stupid shit. The extreme cold. When they die on the mountain, the extreme cold preserves the bodies and keeps them intact just as they fell. And due to the difficulties and dangers in bringing bodies down, because it's so hard to even just go up on your own, let alone bring someone down, most of those who die in the mountain remain where they fall. And the bodies turn into something like a morbid landmark for the climbers who are going up and down. It's like, well, once you pass this person, then you know you're halfway there, and they know them. And they're like talisman. I'm sure they have a moment of silence or something for them.
I hope.
You know what I mean? I think it's like a respectful thing.
Good.
So the first recorded deaths on the mountain were the 7 porters, or Sherpas, who died in an avalanche in 1922 on a British Mount Everest expedition. And the fucking Sherpas, man, these are people who do this all the time and have, you know, dozens of climbs under their belt. They're really incredible, but they also then are more susceptible to accidents because they're going up so
often.
They're
doing it so often.
Right. Yeah. So Sherpa is one of the ethnic groups native to the mountainous regions of Nepal and the Himalayas, and many are highly regarded as elite mountaineers. And Sherpas and their teams are hired by mountain climbers to help manage and advise on their climbs, as well as carry the oxygen, carry the gear, set up camp, and as a safety expert. Because they've lived at that altitude for generations, their bodies are used to it, and they have a genetic natural allowance for it. So many, when you hear people who are like, the guy at the party is like, yeah, I had a solo climb. That guy is bragging that everyone's like, great, Jim. many solo climbers actually use Sherpas.
Sure.
They just fucking call it solo.
Yeah.
So in total, 118 Sherpas have died on Everest between 1921 and 2018. An April 2018 report by NPR stated that Sherpas account for 1/3 of Everest deaths.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Which is so tragic. Okay. And while dangerous for the novice climber, the mountain also has claimed the lives of some of the most experienced climbers. One of the most infamous tragedies on the mountain was the 1996 Mount Everest disaster on May 11th, 1996, during which 8 people died while making summit attempts. So in one day, 8 people died.
Shit.
And there's a really small window of when you're allowed to climb. It's like sometime in May. It's like a few weeks, I think, because it's just like this is when the weather allows it. Go.
Yeah.
So that's like, you know, 18 people. Nope. That's 8 people in a really short period of time. And it was turned into the movie Everest, which I will definitely see at some point. It stars a bunch of famous people.
I've seen
Jake Gyllenhaal.
Yeah, I've seen the beginning of it, and it's good. You want to watch it because I'm pretty sure Josh Brolin is also mm-hmm. in it. He's one of the leaders. There's just a bunch of really good people, and it feels very real the way they shot it. Yeah. It kind of feels like you're just there eavesdropping as all these real people are going to go do this
crazy thing. Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't. Yeah, what a bummer to even shoot that, let alone hike Everest, climb Everest. Excuse me, that's hike is probably insulting. In that entire 1996 season, 15 people died trying to reach the summit, making it the deadliest single year in the mountain's history to that point. On April 18th, 2014, 16 Sherpas were killed in an avalanche that struck base camp. Just over a year later, on April 25th, 2015, 19 people were killed in an avalanche at base camp following a 7.8 earthquake, which killed at least 9,000 people and injured at least 23,000 in Nepal.
Shit.
Yeah. So this is the worst single-day death toll ever in the history of Mount Everest in modern incidents with accurate counts. All right. So on to specific people. Let's talk about the one you've probably heard of and everyone's heard of, Green Boots.
No, I haven't.
Okay.
I mean, not me.
This is like the most famous, I guess you could call it landmark while climbing.
Oh.
So climbers taking the North Col route to Everest summit inevitably end up passing the mountain's most infamous landmark, Green Boots. He's called this because of the brightly colored hiking boots that he was wearing when he died.
Oh.
And I mean, there's photos. Like, they're not gruesome because there's no skin, there's no face. You can say it's fucked up.
Yeah. Do they look like kind of like mummies?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. While Green Boots' identity, but they're covered in their clothes most of the time. While Green Boots' identity has always been hotly contested, he's widely believed to be an Indian climber named Swang Paljor, who died along with two of his colleagues in 1996. So because they can't see his face, they're not sure if it's him or the other two, but they're pretty sure it's him. Paljor was part of a high-class Indian expedition of six people to summit Everest that yielded only one survivor.
Whoa.
Harbhajan Singh. Singh later recalled that the expedition was marred by mistakes, and he had urged the other men to abandon their quest because of inclement weather that was heading in, but Singh and his men refused, and they succumbed to summit fever, a term used when climbers abandon thoughts of safety and often their own morals because they are close to reaching the summit and become blinded by the drive to cross the finish line.
Oh, no.
Above all else. So it's this like, I fucking came here to get to the top. You can't say to someone at a party, I hiked Everest or
two-thirds of the way.
Yeah, yeah. You know?
Yeah.
So they just like, don't think about all the safety, like
it
even their own
whatever
morals,
it takes.
Right.
Yeah.
Which is just not good. So the body of Green Boots looks as though he toppled over from exhaustion mid-stride. Mm-hmm. It looks like he was just doing like a, what do they call it? What's the ski walk thing?
Like cross-country skiing?
Yeah. And mm-hmm. he just like, it looks like he just toppled over. And he did so in what's been now since known as Green Boots Cave. Luckily, his face and skin are obscured, but his blue snow pants, red snow jacket, a couple tanks of oxygen are right where they fell along with him, along with his neon green hiking boots. Paljor's body has become a landmark seen by every climber attempting the northeast ridge route to the summit.
Mm.
So it's like the most famous one.
Wow.
Then there's Frances Arsentive. Frances, her story is fucked up because she was alive when climbers first found her in need of help.
Oh, no.
Yeah, this one's fucked up. So Frances, Arsentive and her husband Sergey were avid climbers who sought to climb Everest in 1998. Frances had a goal to become the first American woman to summit Everest without the use of supplemental oxygen, which is like, yeah.
It's kind of like, that's like wanting to be like the first woman to swim across the ocean without having anybody look out for sharks for her. I mean, isn't it?
Yeah. But it's like you want to be a first something, and that's the only option. So you're going to go for it, even if it's not safe. Like, right. She couldn't just be a woman who'd gotten to the top of Everest.
How about the first woman with a buzz cut,
sure,
on top of Everest? You
Mohawk.
Shave that hair.
Yeah.
Get up there and you just, like, toot all the oxygen you want the entire time.
Toot, motherfucker.
That's the thing you need.
Yeah.
Anyway.
That's right. Don't be a hero.
Let's not put up walls and boundaries in front of ourselves that actually take oxygen away from us.
Right. Whatever you possible. Do, keep the oxygen.
Keep that O2 flowing.
That's right. Toot, toot. So after two aborted attempts of trying to get up on there without supplemental oxygen, she finally succeeded very late in the day on May 22nd, 1998. So she fucking did it and made it. But she became separated from her husband, Sergey, as they descended.
Oh.
Which is, like, so scary. Can you imagine, like, looking down and being like, where'd you go?
Right.
Oh, shit.
And she's all high off of not having oxygen.
And adrenaline.
And adrenaline and whatever other chemicals start going through your body.
Right.
And she's like, oh, look, unicorns. A whole bunch of unicorns.
Yeah.
And she just runs off to the side.
So arriving back to camp around... on May 23rd in the evening, Sergey found that his wife hadn't returned. So even though he was exhausted, he turned around and headed back up the mountain to attempt to rescue her.
Mm-hmm.
On his way up, he passed a team of Uzbek climbers who'd abandoned their own summit attempt to try to help Frances down as far as they could. But they weren't able to get her all the way down. And the following morning, climbers Ian Woodall and Kathy O'Dowd and their team were amazed to find what they thought was a body still alive. So she murmured to them, don't leave me.
Oh.
So she's stuck. She's frozen in place and she's still alive overnight. But she was immobile and slipping in and out of consciousness, and she was beyond rescuing. And there... So after spending nearly an hour with her in the temperatures of minus 30, Ian and Kathy were forced to leave Francis when their own oxygen was running out. So like they wanted to stay with her. They didn't want to leave her. It was like they wouldn't have died too if they had.
Right.
In her book, Just for the Love of It, Kathy O'Dowd writes, quote, "I had never encountered anything like this. I had passed bodies. I had had friends not come back, but I had never watched anyone die, nor had I had to decide to leave them." Neither Sergei or Francis returned. So he went back up to look for her. And
he didn't come back either. Mm-hmm.
And it was later learned that Sergei had fallen to his death trying to reach his wife.
So what he took a weird step and then went down.
It looks like she might have been like have slid down a mountain. And so maybe he saw her and started to try to reach her and fell.
Dang.
So like Green Boots, Francis Arsentiev's body lay right next to the route for years, dressed in her black snow pants and purple snow jacket. And she was passed by hundreds of climbers going to and from the summit and became known as the Mount Everest Sleeping Beauty.
Oh.
In 2007, Ian Woodall, the guy who had to leave her behind, returned with the intention of moving her body out of sight, because I think it's like a respect thing. Like, you know, let's get her out of the way so people don't take photos and shit like that.
Right.
And he covered her with an American flag and placed a note from her family on her body.
Oh.
I know. So David Sharp, like Francis and Sergei, David Sharp was climbing Mount Everest without a support team and without the aid of bottled oxygen. It's believed.
It's a weird pride thing.
I know.
It doesn't make sense.
It's the thing of like, yeah, you need a one up on yourself. Like you can't get high on your own supply anymore. So you're like, I'm going to fucking do this then.
Check this out. It's like being like, I can drink the most shots. Where it's right. Like, yes, you can. And then where will you be?
Yeah, you don't need to.
Right. Where is the true victory?
That's right. So it's believed he made it to the summit on May 14th, 2006. Is that today? No, today's like the 20-something.
close.
I know. But on his way down, fatigued and confused, he stopped and sat down in Green Boots Cave.
Oh, no.
Around 40 climbers from several expeditions are thought to have passed David Sharp on their way up the mountain the next day. A climbing party stopped, and when they realized Sharp was still alive, they didn't make any attempt to rescue him until they passed him again on the way down about 9 hours later. So they were like, we're on our way up. Oh, he's still alive. We'll get him on the way back 9 hours later.
Yeah.
And this, by this point, Sharp, by the time they reached him afterwards, he was alive, but beyond help. And he died frozen in the position he'd sat down to rest in, with his knees like tucked up and his arms kind of huddled around his knees. So, I mean, you can see that the person was just like, I need a rest for a minute. And then they just stay that way.
Right. Because you can't, like, it's almost like he wasn't making good decisions. Then the pack of people
right.
who clearly have the eyes on the prize disease right. you were talking about earlier, they're not going to make the best decision for that guy.
Yeah.
They're not going to be like, forget it. We're going to help you.
That team maintained that they believed Sharp was beyond help on their way up, which may have been true, but it was like a controversial decision still. And, recovering a body requires a shit ton of effort. So, and risk. So most of the time they're just left there, even if they're dying. But a lot of people think that if you see someone in need of help on your way up, it's your duty to halt your mission and help, even if it means abandoning your summit. But people pay between 30 grand and as high as 130 grand.
Right.
To get that fucking experience and opportunity. And so they're not willing to abandon their quest.
No.
We call it that.
Of course not.
To help someone, which is fucked up.
Yeah.
So,
but
I think it's a mountaineering people like, you take a side, you're like, it's, they're torn between whether you do or not.
Well, because it's easy to say you should abandon your quest. Then there's the person who actually sunk 100 grand into
right.
doing this thing that he could die doing too.
Yeah.
I mean, you could kind of argue from any angle. It's yeah. crazy.
But morally, you're going to get back down and be a normal person again. And you're going to have left someone to die.
Yep.
For money, because you spent them like, and for, you know. Glory.
For money and for like cocktail party glory.
Yeah.
Or maybe you get to be in a magazine.
Well, what if you're like, wouldn't you rather hear I save someone on Mount Everest? Yes. At a cocktail party?
Personally, yes.
Yeah, me too. I was going up and this guy was dying. And
although I'm not saying that I would walk away if someone said I actually killed someone on Mount Everest. You well, know
I
that
I
wonder
if there's ever been a murderer.
I mean, that's the perfect place to do it.
Yeah.
But also it's yeah, they're creating their own culture of if I paid this much money, how could I be expected to?
Yeah.
I mean, that's the world
every
we live
man
in
for
now.
Himself kind of a thing.
Yeah.
Or herself.
For real.
And so that's it. Okay. Then George Mallory. George Mallory is one of the oldest bodies on the mountain. When he died on Everest in the 1920s, Mallory was the most famous mountaineer of his time and arguably of our time as well, like of any time.
Mm-hmm.
When asked why he wanted to climb the as then unconquered Mount Everest, Mallory famously replied, because it's there.
Oh, right. I know that guy.
Yeah. But his body wasn't discovered until nearly 75 years later. In 1999.
No. So he died. Did people know he was dead or was he just missing?
I think they must have known he was dead. But yeah, they had not. No one knew where his body was. It was kind of this like, it almost seemed like treasure.
Yes.
You know, like, which are we going to find his body?
Wow.
But so to this day, though, and one of the reasons they wanted to find his body is because to this day, no one is sure whether he and his climbing partner, Sandy Irvine, who also perished on the mountain, reached the summit on the mountain on June 8th, 1924. My birthday. So they don't know if they made it or not because they died and you weren't able to find them. So you couldn't, you know, tell by the evidence if they had.
Right.
So they were climbing. They were climbing. Dressed in the time of what was mountaineering clothes in tweed.
Oh, tweed suits?
Like a fucking professor, like yes. Indiana Jones style. Like these dudes were fucking Indiana Jones.
Yes, they know? Were, weren't they?
They were using incredibly primitive equipment by today's standards and including very clunky oxygen bottles. and yet when they were last sighted, they were just a few hundred vertical feet short of the summit. And according to a fellow expedition member, they were going strongly for the top, but then they disappeared, no sign of them. So they were never seen alive again. And the question whether or not they made it, it remains to this day one of mountaineering's greatest mysteries. An expedition was launched in 1999 to try and find Mallory's body in hopes of solving the mystery. But Mallory's mummified corpse is finally located and you can see photos of it.
Okay.
It's fucking creepy. It's like this, it's like straight up One-Eyed Willy style, like Goonies shit.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But it didn't really reveal much. He appears to have fallen to his death and from the injury around his waist caused by his rope, it has been figured that he and Irvine were still roped together when they fell. So yeah. Irvine's probably farther down the mountain. But two pieces of circumstantial evidence suggest that he did make it to the top. Mallory was found with a pair of snow goggles in his pocket. And it was thought that if he didn't have his snow goggles on anymore, then maybe it was because the sun had gone down, which would imply that they had died late in the night, which means they would have, they were making their way back down, which means they would have made it.
Okay.
And also, he said that when he got to the top, he was going to place a photo of his wife, Ruth, at the top of Everest. And when they found his well-preserved wallet on him, there was no photo of his wife in it.
Okay.
So he well, that's probably made it.
Good.
Yeah.
That's hopeful.
Right.
I pictured them falling into an ice cave.
Mm.
I wonder if I'm getting that from one of those many documentaries. Like that idea that like you step down, you think you're like, you're coming back down or you're going up or whatever it is. And you start thinking.
Like falling through the ice.
Yeah. That basically it's like one false step.
I bet that happens.
But then also in the ice cave is treasure.
And Yetis.
The Yeti family treasure.
So there's also money in the recovery of bodies on Mount Everest. In 2017, a team of local Sherpa climbers recovered the body of three climbers that had been on Everest for a year. The high-risk expedition was financed with about $92,000 from the Indian state of West Bengal.
Mm.
So the expedition sparked this crazy debate about in the mountaineering community about the morality of risking more lives to retrieve bodies from Everest. And in a way, I feel like if you're this like crazy mountaineer, you've been doing it for years and years to get to this one spot of fucking getting to the top of Everest and you die, I feel like a lot of them maybe would want to stay there.
I would think so.
Right?
It's part of the glory of what you were. You died, like, it's literally that he died doing what he loved.
Thing. Yeah. And like scatter my ashes over somewhere I like, you know?
Right.
My pool. I don't know.
Scatter my ashes into my pool. And then please clean them back
out. It's an apartment building pool, but don't just do it.
People need to swim, so if you could clean them back out immediately, that'd be great.
Aung Shering, who's a Sherpa, former president of the Nepal Mountaineering Association, said, because of global warming, the ice sheet and glaciers are fast melting, and the dead bodies that remained buried all those years are now becoming exposed.
Oh, no!
I know.
I love it.
To get one body off the mountain, they are risking the lives of 10 more people. Some 563 climbers scaled the peak from Nepal's southern side in 2018. And I think that must mean right now is when the season's going on.
Yeah, it is.
I bet we'll get those numbers soon. 5 climbers died on Everest in 2018. And as I said, 293 people have lost their lives since the first attempt to scale Everest in 1921, 118 of whom were Sherpa guides. And that is a couple of the many stories of the bodies on Mount Everest.
Amazing.
And you can see photos of them. You know, some are gruesome. They're like mummified. It's creepy.
Crazy.
I love it.
That's amazing. I hate it. That was great.
Thank you.
When they started, like in National Geographic, whatever, they started putting out articles about how all of the ice is melting on the tops of lots of peaks around the, you know, infamous peaks around the world, and that they are starting to find, like Cro-Magnon bodies and like old, this guy was out hunting and he was just about to kill a saber-toothed tiger and like that kind of shit.
And that one guy who got like stabbed in the back too.
Is that like a really, he's like a really old, basically fossil man that they found?
That had been murdered.
I love it.
That, and I love when the ice melts and they find old viruses ice.
Oh, God.
That's going to be the end fucking days.
It's coming soon. Enjoy yourself tonight.
That's right.
Why do I always remember lyrics to songs, Karen, that I haven't heard for years, but I always forget my email passwords?
I know, right? It's like our brains only want us to retain useless information. But with 1Password, that problem's solved.
1Password is an award-winning password manager that's trusted by families and large-scale companies alike.
If you're tired of being the person that everyone texts for a streaming login, hand that honor to 1Password. They let you share logins with people and with groups.
With 1Password, you can securely switch between any device type or operating system. That means if you're a family or business that uses both Mac and PC, you won't have trouble sharing your private data.
Don't let the name fool you. 1Password does more than just store passwords. It can autofill usernames, payment details, and personal information. And they notify you about potential data breaches.
For business operations, 1Password has a dedicated support team that will integrate its security tools into your existing workflow.
1Password saves everyone time. And we all know that time saved equals money saved. Your accounting department will thank you.
Don't just listen to us. 1Password was named Wirecutter's best password manager, and companies like Salesforce and IBM trust 1Password to secure their most sensitive information, so you can too.
Right now, our listeners get a free 2-week trial at 1Password.com/MFM.
That's 2 free weeks at 1, as in the number 1, password.com/MFM.
1Password.com/MFM.
Goodbye.
Do you want to know what I was going to do?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm going to do.
I kind of have to, but I also want to.
You can't. Don't look away from this.
I'm going to go in the other room. That's cool.
Please don't. Just stay.
Okay.
Because we were just in Minneapolis, St. Paul area, Minnesota. Thank you all, Minneapolis and Milwaukee, for enabling us to have such a wonderful end to our tour.
Yeah, with some fucking great hometowns.
Oh, my God. Stacy.
Like the best Stacy. What a crumb. tell the story real quick.
Just when we were in Milwaukee, Georgia picked a woman named Stacy who came up, and she's a forensic. She's a teacher.
Psychology professor, I think.
Yeah. Or psychology professor. She's just great. Had a great accent. Told the story really well. Very earnestly. But then in the middle, she was describing how this man killed his wife, I believe, mm-hmm. and it was very gruesome and terrible. And the audience at one point made a noise about what a bummer it was. And then she just stops and goes, I know, he's a real crumb. And I was trying not to, I always want to say shit while people are telling their story, oh, yeah. but I know it's going to throw them off.
Yeah.
So I try to be quiet and just
let
them tell it.
Your face just made me start cracking up.
It was the best thing I've ever heard.
You were so happy about it. It made me laugh so hard to see you trying not to fucking lose your shit.
I feel like a lady named Stacy who it takes the time to describe us like this murderer.
Mm-hmm.
As a crumb is the exact opposite of us, where we'll describe fucking a fluffy kitten as a fucking bitch or whatever, you know what I mean? Like we just, it's the idea of that where it's like, that's as far as she was willing to go. It just was the most charming.
Bless her heart.
Bless her little heart. So this is one of the stories that I prepped and then was like, there's no way I can do this. It's just too much.
Great.
But also because I've been given the confirmation multiple times that you haven't done this one yet. And I still think you have.
Oh my God.
The weepy voice killer.
I have not done it.
Okay.
I have thought about it so many times. Oh, I'm ready.
And is it because I hate 911 calls?
No.
Oh.
Maybe. I wonder maybe it's because it needs that. And you don't, no, I don't know why. I just never did it.
Yeah. Oh, I didn't either. And then I was going to, but as I was going through it, it's so hard to do. Well, if they're famous, that's one thing.
Yeah.
And everyone kind of knows them or whatever. But sometimes when, and we've talked about this a bunch of times, when it's just a killing, no one's solving the crime.
Tragic childhood from the serial killer. And it's just like, oh, okay. Oh, man.
There's just no, I can't get in there and then be like, he looks like.
Yeah, yeah.
Look what actor, look, it's Dustin Hoffman. You can't do that in certain stories.
It's not funny.
Nor should you.
No.
Okay. So I got information from heresthefuckingtwist.com.
Ooh.
Uh-huh. The Criminal Minds wiki page.
Okay.
Which is hilarious. And a website called Criminally Intrigued.
All right.
.com, which has a really good, their logo for Criminally Intrigued is the bottom part of a jaw and then a tooth that's kind of like over here.
Ooh.
Like a loose tooth set to the side.
All right.
It's very.
Set that thing aside.
Right?
Come back to it.
It's well designed. It's beautifully designed and interesting. Okay. So we're going to start on New Year's Eve, 1980, and a 20-year-old University of Stevens Point, Wisconsin student named Stevens Point is a very small town in northern Wisconsin that my friend Bradford Burleski is from.
It was in your story last time.
Yes.
Last 2 weeks ago.
Yes.
Weird.
Isn't that weird?
Yeah.
And it's not big at all.
Huh.
And there's a woman we met in the meet and greet who said she was from there. And that's when I was like, my friend Bradford's from
there.
Anyway.
Okay.
Okay.
Start over.
So, New Year's Eve, 1980.
Okay.
So, this 20-year-old who goes to University of Stevens Point, Wisconsin, her name is Karen Potak, and she's just gotten to St. Paul because she's coming to celebrate New Year's Eve with her sisters. Mm. And so, they are going to a party somewhere. There's an article that said they were throwing the party.
Mm-hmm.
But whatever it is they end up at this New Year's party, and Karen, along with everybody else in America, gets drunk.
Yeah.
And she ends up wandering away from the party after midnight and just starts kind of walking around the city drunk.
I do that shit, too.
I know.
Like, I'll be like, this party's too loud. I'll grab the dog in a leash and just fucking walk away from a party. And then you're kind of drunk and you're just like, everything's so beautiful out.
Yeah.
It's so stupid.
It's, well, yeah. I mean,
that's stupid. It's just.
It's risky.
It's risky. Thank you.
It's a risky thing. It's good to do with a dog.
It sucks that we can't, as women, fucking do that.
Just do it and kind of wander around drunk and have a good time.
Yeah.
It also makes me think of, too, it's that thing. How I would do every party where you kind of go into it with all this hope and this idea of what cool could happen.
Yeah.
And it makes me feel like maybe she liked somebody and then at midnight he kissed somebody else.
Or he wasn't even there. He didn't even show up.
Yeah. Or just nobody good showed up. Or it was just that kind of thing of like, oh, I got to get away from this party.
I need to be alone. Yeah.
Yeah. Around 3 in the morning, police get a call from a man asking for a squad car to be sent to the Malberg Manufacturing Company machine shop on Pierce Butler Road because there's, quote, a girl hurt there. And the caller's voice is very shaky and filled with emotion. And when the police ask for his name, he hangs up. And when the officers get there, they find Karen's naked body in a snowbank near the railroad tracks, and she's been beaten with a tire iron.
Oh my God.
So severely that her skull's been cracked, they can see her brain. But
holy
she's alive.
What?
She fucking survived.
No.
Yes. She survives. Now, she doesn't have any memory of the attack. It really, of course, very severely affected her memory.
Oh, my God.
And she had to, you know, work back from that
place.
But she lived through it.
Oh, honey.
Yes. But they have no, it just seems like this this random attack. Okay.
Are we going to listen to any of them or no?
Well, yes.
Okay.
So Stephen has them standing by.
Okay.
And so we'll go in. Let me do this one first, because that one was, you know, she lived, and it was basically the first one.
Okay.
So the next one is Kimberly Compton. This is the second attack, but the first murder. So on June 3rd, 1981, a group of boys are walking through a wooded area by Interstate 35, St. Paul. Mm-hmm. And they come across the body of 18-year-old Wisconsin student Kimberly Compton. She has been stabbed with an ice pick 61 times.
Oh, my God.
And she then was strangled with a shoelace.
Oh, yeah.
So at the same time, another call is made to the police. And the caller, tearful, full of emotion, reports the crime that he committed. And he tells the police, goddamn, will you find me? I just stabbed somebody with an ice pick. I can't stop myself. I keep killing somebody is the phrase that he uses. And then they trace the call. They get to a payphone at a bar across the street from a local bus depot. But by the time they get there, of course, the guy's gone.
Uh-huh.
The killer's gone. 2 days later, he calls again. And here's the phone call.
Oh my God. This is the first time in the history of My Favorite Murder where we played a 911 call.
We're gonna play a 911 call, and it's purely so we can hear.
Yeah.
Don't talk, just listen. I'm sorry what I did to Compton. I couldn't help it. Don't know why I had to stab her. I am so upset about it. I keep getting drunk every night. I can't believe it. It's like a big dream. I can't think of being locked up. If I get locked up, I'll kill myself. I'd rather kill myself than get locked up. I'll try not to kill anybody else.
So I don't like 911 calls because, well, most of the time, if it is the killer, it's oftentimes a husband pretending to be upset when he's actually not.
But just hearing the people actually upset.
Being upset.
Is upsetting.
But this is, for some reason, this is different to me because he's just talking about himself.
Yeah.
He has just murdered someone so viciously and insanely. And he's calling and acting like he's upset that he did that.
Right.
But really, he just immediately starts talking about how he can't go to jail.
Right.
And that this is all like very sad for him.
Yeah.
And also just that, if I ever had to listen to really anybody, but especially a man talking in that tone of voice.
Like a cowardly lion?
Sir.
It sounds like the cowardly lion.
It totally does. I'll beat him up.
Don't talk. I'll take him up. Listen.
I don't know.
Oh, you may.
Yeah. It's, I would have, as a 911 dispatcher, probably been very disrespectful to that man.
Aye.
He does not turn himself in, as he just said in that phone call. Mm-hmm. He does kill someone else. So on July 21st, 1982, a woman named Carol Kellogg goes to her friend's house, Kathleen Greening. They're going to go on vacation to Mackinac Island. And Carol knocks on the door. Nobody answers. Then she tries the door and it's unlocked. Mm. So she goes into the house and she calls for Kathleen and no one answers. So she starts looking around the house, checking every room, and Kathleen's not there. And finally, Carol notices that the bathroom light's on. So she goes upstairs to the bathroom door and she opens it and she finds Kathleen's naked body lying face up in a filled bathtub. And her head is under the tap, or her legs are down to the other side. So she calls the police. Police arrive, and they ultimately rule Kathleen's death an accident.
No.
Because there's no proof that anything nefarious happened. But Kathleen's friends and family don't think it's an accident, and they actually think that her estranged husband could be responsible. But there's the police look into him, and there's no charges are filed against him. About a month later, on August 5th, the same year, 40-year-old Barbara Simons goes out for a night at the Hexagon Bar in Minneapolis, and she meets a man there. She he's about to smoke a cigarette. She offers him one. Then later on, he offers her a ride home, and she says yes. And as she's leaving, she actually says to the bartender, he's cute. I hope he's nice since he's giving me a ride home. And then they leave. So the next morning, August 6th, there's a basically a paper boy, but it might be an adult. Is walking along the Mississippi River, and they find Barbara's body, her dead body. She's been stabbed over 100 times.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
That's rage stabbing, you know?
Beyond. I mean, yeah.
But he doesn't even know these women.
Right. It's insane overkill.
Yeah.
And must be so disturbing for the people that find these bodies.
Oh, geez.
Again, the police get another phone call. And it's the same voice. And this time, he's full on crying. And he once again starts the call, please don't talk, just listen. Which is how he's starting these calls. Do you want to try the next one?
Okay.
By your emergency.
Please don't talk, just listen. I'm sorry I killed that girl. I stabbed her 40 times. Kimberly Compton was the first one. Oh, my shame. Oh, I don't know what's the matter with me. I'm sick. I'm going to kill myself, I think.
Where are you?
I'm just going to... If somebody dies with a red shirt on, it's me. I killed both people.
Calm down. Dispatcher.
Yeah.
Calm down.
It's not real.
The emotion?
Yeah. I always thought it was when I've heard it in the past, but now I'm like, no, he just wants credit for these murders.
And attention.
Attention and credit. And
he's crying for himself.
Yeah.
The last thing he said, you could barely understand it. He says, I've killed more people. I'll never make it to heaven. He's crying about himself.
Yeah.
And I think there's, you know, obviously there's that interesting, like, is this a Jekyll and Hyde situation where he's doing these crazy overkill murders, waking up and then feeling bad.
Wait, so he just took credit for the woman who drowned, right?
No. Kimberly Compton, who is the first one who was stabbed and strangled with the shoelace.
Okay.
He did not take credit for that. And
because, how do they change it? You're going to tell me probably.
Yes. It's a reveal.
Okay.
Yes.
Then I won't.
She doesn't actually fit into the MO.
Yeah.
So actually that one it stands alone cold for a while.
Okay. Tell me.
And again, normally I can't take 911 calls at all, but there's something about this one that is just like, it's just like the dispatcher that finally breaks in. That's like, calm down. Like,
yeah.
What are you even doing?
Yeah.
What is this
it's
for?
Like he's leading this thing that no one else has anything to do with it. He wants control over. Ugh, it's creepy.
It's so creepy. And also, but then he's just kind of complaining.
Yeah.
He's complaining.
Yeah.
Okay. So investigators start their search for the killer, trying to identify the man that Barbara left the bar with the night before. So the witnesses, they all tell authorities that they remember seeing Barbara leave with a man that was around 40 years old, 6 feet tall, 185 pounds. He's a white man with a receding hairline. Okay, so then on August 21st, 1982, so this is basically a month after that, police are still searching for Barbara Simons' killer from the Hexagon Bar when a 19-year-old Minneapolis sex worker named Denise Williams is out on the streets working. A client approaches her, they talk about pricing, and then she gets into his car. They drive to a secluded location, they have sex, and then afterwards, he says he's going to drive her back home. And then as they're driving, Denise notices that they're actually going further away into an area that she doesn't recognize. They're not going back to the city.
Yeah.
It's a very dark suburban area. She's starting to get uneasy and she knows she's in danger.
Yeah.
She, has a bottle near her leg that she has. She just knows where it is.
Yeah.
So she's kind of prepped. He pulls off onto a dead end street, turns and starts stabbing her with a screwdriver. But she's ready, so she grabs the bottle from the floor of the car and smashes him in the head.
Yes!
And then she starts screaming, and she actually wakes up a neighbor nearby who comes out of his house. He tackles the attacker to the ground and saves Denise, but the attacker ends up escaping. And by the end of the whole thing, Denise has been stabbed with a screwdriver 15 times.
Holy shit.
Yeah. So the neighbor calls an ambulance for Denise, and then he tells the police all about what the attacker looks like. And meanwhile, the attacker has made his way back to his apartment, and he...
But they have his car.
No, he got away.
Okay.
But when he gets to his apartment, he calls an ambulance for himself.
No.
Uh-huh. So it's another 911 call, and he's calling in saying, I need help, and doing the same weird voice. And the dispatcher who takes that call from him goes, this is that person that keeps calling and saying they've killed somebody, and then someone ends up stabbed to death. And so the dispatcher basically tells the police, I think this is the same guy that's been calling in these murders. And so police show up at the attacker's apartment, and he is finally identified as 37-year-old Paul Michael Stefani. He's arrested, and he's charged with second-degree assault for Denise Williams's attack.
Okay,
so as they dig deeper into Stefani's background, they're able to connect Barbara Simon's murder to him because of the eyewitness account. So there's a waitress who saw Barbara Simon's leave the Hexagon Bar with a man that she knew was Paul Stefani. She knew his name.
No.
So when the police came back around to look into Stefani, she was like, oh yes, that she left with Paul.
What?
I know that's who it was. So they look into Paul Stefani's background, and they see that he used to work at the Marlboro Manufacturing Company, which was the place he was fired there in March of 1977, which was 3 years before, Karen Pollock's attack. And that's the place where her body was found.
Oh, yay.
So basically they're able to add a murder charge for Barbara Simons on top of the assault charge for Denise Williams. So little tiny bit of background about Paul Stefani. There's not much, and it's not that interesting, but he was born September 8th, 1944 in Austin, Minnesota. He was one of 10 kids, super religious family, and super repressed. He married a woman as an adult named Beverly Leiter, and they had a daughter together, but they later divorced. Mm. Basically, Stefani goes to trial for that murder and for the attack, and his ex-wife Beverly, his sister, and his former roommate all come to testify that the voice that you hear on these 911 calls is his voice.
Oh my God.
They're all there saying that's him.
Yeah.
Basically are just trying to get the charges that they have for these attacks, and then connect these other ones that have gone cold. They want to link to him. But because he becomes so incoherent at the end of those calls, and it turns into that, they can't like directly connect it, because basically it could be anybody making that noise. It's not distinctly his voice. But even still, Stefani is found guilty in both the second degree assault charge and the murder charge for Barbara Simon's death, and they give him 40 years in prison.
That's
so,
it?
Yeah. 40 years.
40 years.
Yeah. Yeah. So in 1997, he's 53 years old. He's still in prison, and he gets diagnosed with skin cancer. And when the doctors tell him he has about a year to live, he tells the authorities that he has other confessions about other attacks that he wants to make. He says he wants to apologize to the victim's family before he dies. So on a taped confession, he confesses to the murders of Kathleen Greening, Kimberly Compton, and the tire iron attack on Karen Pollock. And he hadn't even been a suspect in the Greening case. That's the one where she was in the bathtub. And because there was no phone calls made, that was like a really early one. And he just basically gave it to them.
Wow.
Yeah. So about in 1998, a year later after that, Stefani dies at Oak Parks Heights Maximum Security Prison, just shy of his 54th birthday.
Jesus.
And that is the short and upsetting story of the weepy voiced killer.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
I hate him.
Isn't he the worst?
Yeah. I'm glad one of us finally did that.
I know.
I don't know why we haven't.
I know.
Well,
I mean, I think I've been so anti.
Oh, yeah, because of the... And then maybe I just didn't want to play it for you. So it's good that you did it.
Yeah.
Because now I'm not forcing anything on you.
Well, and also I realize it's like, I want to paint that with a broad brush of like, I don't ever want to hear any 911 call, yeah. which is true, except for there's something about this one. Yeah. It's like, it feels different.
No, it is. It totally is.
And it's just so like, I don't know. It just fascinates me. It's just that thing of these people and these fucking crazy murderers who then also think, I just don't, it's so fascinating what they think and the way they do things. They're just like, yeah. he's crying for himself. He feels worse for himself than anybody in yeah. that situation.
Just that void of humanity. That
but still able
have.
To pity himself
yeah.
is amazing to me.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah.
Fucking A, man.
Fucking A.
Good job.
Fucking hooray.
Yeah.
Fucking hooray time. I guess I will say this one, and I'm not sure if you're going to remember this, but it was a couple years ago. My niece Lauren was down here, down south, going to college, just out of high school, and she really hated it immediately and was really miserable and having a terrible time. And she would come and hang out with me every once in a while just because she was like, it was a really small school. It was a really weird area. She wasn't her room. Nothing was working out yeah. the way she wanted it to.
She wanted some familiarity.
Yeah. So she would come and hang out with me and just kind of like tell me about how much she hated it. And just, she just felt like she made the wrong decision, which is heartbreaking.
Yeah.
Today, she graduated from Berkeley.
Oh my God.
With an anthropology degree. Because she is such a badass that in that time, she basically went to her parents and was like, I can't go to this college anymore. I'm so miserable. And her parents were like, didn't want to let her just quit.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're going to say you should actually just go here for 2 more years. It's better for your, they had kind of had this plan in place. Yeah. And then I basically was like, if I could just yeah. on her behalf say, I get why you want to like hold the line on this, but
right.
it really does suck. And it's a tiny school and
2 years is a very long time, especially when you're young and miserable.
Right. And she does have a plan. She just doesn't yeah. want to do it down there. It's not like she's like partied her way out of school
right.
like me.
And it's not like it'll ding your record that much that you'll never get a job once you get out of college or whatever.
Right. And also I think it's a thing of like, I think she was nervous about it too. All of this is to say uh-huh. that, you know, this was a low time in her life. And what she did was basically just kind of like pack it up, go home, get into the JC. And she just started working and she knew where she wanted to be.
Yeah.
And she worked her way into Berkeley.
Amazing.
Which is one of the best schools there is.
Yeah.
And got to the point where she graduated like it very quickly. And she just, I don't know, she just turned it all around. Like her life is so different than it was when all that happened. And I'm just so proud of her. So anyway, I'm just thrilled. And but it also is that thing of if you make a decision and you're like, here's the big thing I'm going to do. And you go down that road for a while and you don't like it. You get to change your mind.
Totally.
It's hard. Like, I'm sure there's parents that'll weigh in. There's lots of people, especially if you're spending their money. There's lots of people that have lots of opinions. And there's lots of times where people won't make that decision because they go like, oh, everybody at home will find out.
Right.
And I'll be ashamed because everybody else is doing this and that. And how do I compare and blah, blah, blah. And you cannot make decisions for yourself and for your future based on what other people are going to think. You have to do what's good and right for you and best for you. And you have to like figure out your path and you get to figure and refigure it a couple times.
Yeah.
And I think she's just this shining example of how you can do that and you can start over and go like basically recalibrate and do whatever you want.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah.
Good
yeah.
for her. Congratulations.
I know. I'm so proud of her.
Yeah, I bet. Mine is a piece of paper that I got in therapy today. That is a list of the 10 classic unhelpful thinking styles.
10.
Yeah. Yeah.
Let's hear them.
My brain feels broken a lot because I go to the wrong spot when, you know, like Vince is going to hate me if I ask if he'll do the laundry, you know, like it just doesn't compute correctly sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And so our therapist gave this to me that was like, everyone does that. It's totally normal. Maybe yours does a little more than everyone else's, but it's normal. And so,
but probably not.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. So there, I'll just name it, but you can look up 10, the 10 classic unhelpful thinking styles, I think is what it's called. Do you want to hear them?
Yeah.
All or nothing thinking.
Yep.
A mental filter, paying attention to only certain types of advice, jumping to conclusions, emotional reasoning, assuming that because we feel a certain way and what we think must be true, labeling ourselves, overgeneralizing, disqualifying the positive.
Hi.
Magnification, catastrophizing, and minimization. So like everything's the worst, whatever I've done that good, it doesn't count.
Right.
Using critical words like should, must, and ought, and personalization, like this is my fault. And I do all of those a lot. But then I was like, Vince and I afterwards, I was like, do you do those? Because Vince always seems so like fucking together to me. He's like, yeah, all the time. Like even him looks like, you know, affected by it. So that's kind of nice.
Right. Everybody is.
Yeah.
Yeah. It just doesn't seem like it because they're on the outside.
Right.
Not having to deal with the shit that you hear on the inside.
It just seems so much easier for other people to like get it, especially when you can't.
Yeah.
So that's it. Mental health.
Yeah. That's good.
Yeah. Check out our podcasts on Exactly Right Network. They're doing some really cool shit. We have Murder Squad, fucking Percast, the Do You Need a Ride? This Podcast Will Kill You, and The Fall Line. And The Fall Line is doing until June 20th. They're having a contest. If you donate $10 towards the billboard
the Milbrook Fund.
Yeah, $10 towards the Millbrook Fund, and you can go on The Fall Line, their Instagram, and read all about it. You get put into a contest to get a signed copy of our book. So check that out.
Yeah. And it's and then the proceeds of that all go toward keeping that billboard up.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's super cool. I love that those guys, they're all actually doing stuff. Yeah. They're taking some action. Yeah. It's really exciting.
Totally. Cool. Thanks for listening, guys.
And what else? That's it, right?
I think so.
Yeah. Thanks for sticking around.
Yeah.
And stay sexy.
And don't get murdered.
Goodbye.
Elvis, do you want a cookie?